Okay, so we'll get through this and then we'll be finished the course. Yes. You went way past that? Okay, so we were, oh, wrong remote. So we talked about the esophagus and issues. This is a side thing we can see here. You know, rectus abdominis. Remember, we had all that connective tissue that separated, transversus from external internal obliques and so on and so forth. So a hernia, then, is a weakness of the tissues around the inguinal canal that leads to tears and separation of the tissues. So if we think about, you know, where the muscles line up and how they relate to each other, we have fascia or connective tissue that lies between them. So inguinal canal, of course, is formed by the fascia to the abdominal muscles on one side and the internal oblique on the other, which we can kind of see here. Here's the inguinal canal here. Here's the inguinal ligament. So we're talking sort of in this area right here. Inside the canal, we find in men we find the spermatic cord, and in women we find what's called the round ligament, which does help hold some of the organs, female sex organs, up. The inguinal hernia represents the vast majority of all of them, about 75%. Indirect infants as a result of congenital patency are a hole in the process vaginalis. And so you have like a congenital issue where there's just weakness or a hole. Adults, it's a weakening and widening of the internal ring. And brackets I have here, the peritoneal sac is able to slip into the ring. So we can see here that we've got this inguinal ring here and then the canal, and then we have a superficial inguinal ring here. So what happens is under normal anatomical movement, the testes does grow sort of internally inside the child, the male child, and then drops down into the scrotum via that tube. And yes, Cloyd. On my slides? Okay. Okay. So the inguinal is the most popular, and you can get you'll get part of the peritoneal tissues that will drive into the ring itself. So you'll get sort of the tissues in here sliding down the canal in the ring in this cord-like manner here. Direct hernias is the second most common type. This is a deficient number of transversus abdominal aponeurotic fibers at what is known as the Hasselbalch triangle. So we have to remember, if we go back here, do you remember what the aponeurotic fibers do for the abdominals? Do you remember how they all come together? They form a fascial package for the rectus group. So some of the aponeurotic fibers go behind the rectus. Some go anterior to it because rectus, yeah, the sheath that's in the front, and then you have the linea alba down the middle. Okay, so what we're saying here is that aponeurotic fiber at this Hasselbalch triangle gets weakened, and then you get this separation that's occurring. So this is more common in older adults, whereas inguinal tends to be younger. You can have something called a femoral hernia, and you get a loop of intestine that goes into the femoral canal. And presents in an enlarged femoral ring with corresponding narrow transverse abdominis upon neurosis. And you see this in multiparous women. Do you know what multiparous women are? Nope. Women who've had many, many, many babies. So they get weakened. It gets weakened to being, what's that? Yeah, how many children has your mom had? Eight? Oh, wow. Okay, hello. So you have eight, okay. No, but 8 or 9 or 10 would represent a multiparous woman, where you'll get weakness here and then you'll have a problem with it. Umbilical hernia caused by increased abdominal pressure against the umbilical ring and fascia. There was actually a teacher here who had an umbilical hernia and literally would get the size of an apple almost, like kind of sticking right out through here. Incisional hernia, so this is something what happens is you have incision done for, say, abdominal surgery or something, and you don't get these good collagen links, and the skin gets intact, but the underlying tissues don't, and you get slippage through as far as that goes. Sports hernia. Now, this is something that's it's not really a hernia. It's actually more of a pubalgia. So if we think of everything that attaches onto the pubic bone in terms of ligaments and muscle tissue like the rectus group and so forth, this is where it's happening. So you get pain in the pubic joint, better named an athletic, should be better named as a pubalgia. It ends up being a tendinosis that involves the rectus abdominis, internal oblique and transversus, and the pubic joint with associated dilation of the external inguinal ring. So what you get is basically, at those points of attachment on the pubic bone, you basically get a tendinosis. You get inflammation, which results in these problems. Quite often, you know, athletes who are demanding to do a lot of work within their core, this work kind of comes from. You can see here, here's your aponeurosis of the external oblique here. We can see that we have this whole femoral sheath here and the hole that things pass through. And you can see here's the superficial inguinal ring in the pubic tubercle. So what happens is you get inflammation here, and then you get a widening of this ring, which then causes pain, discomfort, and so forth. This is an umbilical hernia that we see here. And this is an inguinal hernia that we see here. So the inguinal ligament, of course, running from the ASIS down to the pubic bone, and you get the inguinal ring gets enlarged, and then you get peritoneal tissue that runs down through. So this, if you saw something like this, you literally could push that back up into the abdominal wall, and it would pop back out again. Quite often, a patient who has an inguinal hernia will say, it gets bothered, but when they sit down to have a bowel movement and they do a Valsalva to push, pops out, and then they push it back in again. Mm-hmm. There you go. No. The patient does. They're able to. My brother had one. He had it repaired, and it would stick out, and he would just use his hand, his fingertips, and push the tissue back in. Sorry? I wouldn't believe so. And if you think of, if you see, if it's this in particular, for example, do we work in this area? No. Not really, right? So, I mean, we wouldn't be dealing with it anyways as far as that goes. Like if had, this? I think when it's, you know, some patients are able to push it back in, but not all. I haven't come across a whole lot of that. But, you know the innies and outies? Okay, that actually is an umbilical hernia in a baby. An outie is an umbilical hernia. Yeah. So. It's a good question. It probably has to do with connective tissue that stays together and doesn't separate. No, exactly. Now, there is an association with this with gross obesity, obviously. Right, in terms of path of least resistance as the adipose tissue builds. If it's weak, it's gonna come out, right? So, because my grandson, he's got a pretty good outie, and he's had it ever since he was born. And he tries to push it back, and he plays with it all the time, right? As far as that goes. I think it has probably has a greater potential for it, but not unless they get, again, anybody I've seen who has that tend to have the pretty good beer belly going on at the same time. But you can see also in here, you know, here we can see how, here's the canal, inguinal canal here that's been enlarged, and we actually get a piece of intestine that actually comes down the canal and pokes out. So the canal is significantly large enough that part of the intestines, because of the peritoneal pressure that's in there, will actually come down through the canal and pop out the bottom. This is kind of known in layman's terms as a strangulation hernia. And if they don't do something about it, there's a potential that this little bit of intestine that's popped out the distal part of the inguinal tube will actually become ischemic and necrotic and die. Abdominal clinical manifestation. So, of course, most common is intermittent or persistent bulge. with intermittent and persistent pain. The inguinal usually starts as a small marble-sized lump under the skin and is painless and, as I said, can be pushed back in, and consistent abdominal pressure increases the size of the lump. So eventually, if it pops out enough and gets larger, the only way to solve the problem is to go in surgically and repair it and put it all back together again. When it gets to the point that it can't be pushed back in, and the pain is usually localized and sharp. When able to push back in, it's called reducible. And if you cannot push it back in, if the patient can't push it back in, it's either called incarcerated or irreducible. And when it gets to that point, then surgery is the only way to deal with the problem. And as I said, there are a number of different abdominal hernia approaches. One of the ones, I don't know if you've ever followed this in the past, but there was a mesh that was put in years ago, and it turned out that mesh was very poor, was causing inflammation and problems and all that kind of stuff. Appendicitis. Have you guys talked about McBurney's point? Okay. So inflammation of the vermiform appendix that often results in perforation and necrosis with subsequent local or general peritonitis. Now, acute is classified as simple, gangrenous, or perforated. So simple would mean just a contained infection into the appendix itself. Obviously, gangrenous would be quite serious because you've now got some issues going on there from a bacterial infection. And then perforated means it's actually perforated, split open, and infectious material is heading out into the peritoneal cavity, which could result in, of course, peritonitis. And peritonitis is actually a deadly, if not dealt with, can be quite deadly. Can occur at any age, peak incidence between 15 and 19, and males more than females. Half of all cases have no cause, and one-third caused by obstruction that prevents normal drainage. And that can be from a tumor, an existing tumor possibly happening, a fecal material, so you get impacted fecal material, those who can't go to the bathroom well, then it gets plugged up a little bit. Parasites or lymphoid hyperplasia. When we look at the appendix, it does have a very small lumen. If it becomes obstructed, then you get inflammation with swelling and hyperemia of the appendix. Intraluminal pressure, so within that little lumen, you have the pressure that rises, and then you get ischemia because the pressure gets large enough to actually cut off its own blood supply. And of course, when you have no blood, you get ischemia, and then from ischemia, you go to necrosis and then perforation. So quite often, you know, it's this pressure and this results in ischemia that brings the patient to the hospital saying, I have this terrible pain. So the classic sequence is abdominal pain, which is epigastric, periumbilical, or lower right quadrant. They have anorexia. What's anorexia? Right, not eating. They don't want to eat. Nausea, vomiting, and low-grade fever in adults. If it's a high fever, they likely have a perforation. Pain is constant. It can shift within 12 hours of onset to the right lower quadrant point with tenderness over this McBurney's point. Has anybody here ever lost their appendix or had appendicitis? So anybody I've ever known as a student, because you've probably been taught, right, you push on the McBurney's point, then you quickly release. So you'll push down, you'll quickly release, and they'll scream out in bad pain. It's quite obvious that it's a positive test. It's very uncomfortable. Atypical presentation occurs in 40 to 50%. It's then due to where anatomically the tip of the appendix can be found. And you can imagine, you know, in doing comparisons between different patients, the tip of the appendix can be in a multitude of different places and directions, right? So you can see here how this appendix can look. That's the variations that you can get in terms of how the diversity of patients who have appendixes, which we all do, you can have quite a variation as to where that appendix is. And that will have some influence on the presentation of discomfort or pain. Peritonitis, I've already talked about that where everybody remembers where the peritoneum is, correct? And you remember there is a serous membrane in there, right? Okay, so it's inflammation of the serous membrane lining the walls of the abdominal cavity. And what happens is you get microorganisms that go into the peritoneal cavity. Now, that can be from, obviously, a stab wound or something from the outside getting in. It can also be from something that's perforated the bowel. So if you get leaking of bowel material, whether that's semi-digested foods or fecal matter through the large colon, then of course that brings with it associated bacteria. It can get in there, and of course then you've got a big problem. So you can occur spontaneously or secondary. Could be that there was a trauma or surgery or peritoneal contamination by bowel contents, right? So the bowel splits or has an opening. Another cause can be colonoscopy. So colonoscopy can perforate a bowel, which results in leaking of the bowel material. Spontaneous is almost always associated with ascites and cirrhosis. So you get that fluid accumulation in the gut and the blocked liver that results in increased pressure, and it can cause pressure within the bowels, which can cause it to leak. Secondary occurs as a result of inflammation of abdominal organs or irritating substances from a perforated gallbladder, intestine or gastric ulcer, or rupture of a cyst or irritation of blood. So you can get peritonitis from a significant ovarian cyst. You can get material released out, and it can cause inflammation and an inflammatory response to it. Bacteria quickly spreads throughout the abdominal cavity and then very quickly can enter into the blood because of the type of tissues that are in there, which results in septicemia. Basically, septicemia is blood poison. And if you get it, if it's not dealt with very quickly, it can kill you very quickly. Chemical peritonitis, non-infectious inflammation caused by a bile leakage. So if you've got gallbladder issues and the gallbladder leaks, that material that comes out, it will really irritate and cause inflammation. GI contents leaking into the cavity can cause it, and then you go from that initial inflammation, the contents that leaks eventually becomes rotten, if you want to call it that, and you get ensuing bacterial issues. This can be a result of banding if it's not done properly, so stomach banding, for weight loss. Gastric blood, or sorry, gastric acid, blood or foreign material from surgery can cause it, as well as acute pancreatitis, which can be a result of, it on its own can be idiopathic and not have known cause. So, of course, that peritoneal space under normal circumstances is sterile. So, we want it that way. And what can happen is when we get introduction of bacteria, we get a significant inflammatory response. You end up then with fibrinopurine exudate. So there's fibrin in here. It then becomes very pustulant. Because of it, it ends up covering the peritoneal surface that you end up with, then with fibrotic lesions, which can result in obstructions and usually within something like an abscess. The ability for the peritoneum to fight the inflammatory process is quickly overwhelmed, which results in circulatory alterations, fluid shifts, and respiratory problems. So, because a lot of fluid is controlled through the gut, and you end up with these big shifts in the peritoneum, then you end up with these massive electrolyte imbalances. And electrolyte imbalances can result in, heart arrhythmias, kidneys shutting down, brain function disappearing, so on and so forth. So, it's all about having this big shift in electrolytes. When you obviously have inflammation going on in the gut, you also have blood that's shunted to that area because, blood's a major part of an inflammatory response. So you get blood to the area, you end up with peristaltic activity, which stops, and then, of course, you end up then with a bowel obstruction. If it continues to progress, you end up with severe abdominal pain. The abdominal cavity becomes very fluid-filled and actually becomes hard as a rock, and very sensitive to touch by the physician. Pain can refer to shoulder or thoracic area because of those associations, especially if it's pushing on the diaphragm, goes to the shoulder. If this continues, nausea, vomiting, and fever follow. Without treatment, you get a paralytic ileus, so it doesn't work anymore. Then you end up with sepsis, of course, which is blood poisoning, and then all of a sudden, because of that and the electrolytes and everything else that's going on, you get multi-organ failure that occurs, everything shuts down, and the individual dies. Hemorrhoids. We've talked about them a lot, especially in semester one. So they are atrial-venous communications covered by a cushioning of connective tissue that lie just beneath the mucous membranes lining the lowest part of the rectum and the anus. So, we know that hemorrhoids you can get this kind of stuff happening in arteries or in veins, more commonly in veins, of course. And then you get them sort of becoming engorged and enlarged just under this mucous membrane, which lines this lower part of the rectum and anus. Hemorrhoids can be internal or they can be external. So that we're talking, in and above that dentate line, which we can kind of see, where's my little thing? Sort of the dentate line's kind of right here. So outside that line is considered external, inside that line is considered internal. They're very common. Symptoms occur when the vessels pathologically dilate, so you end up with vascular congestion or what's called a mucosal prolapse, so the mucous membrane, it breaks down or becomes weakened and the blood vessel comes out. Vascular congestion can occur from prolonged straining or increased abdominal pressure. So therefore, chronic constipation can cause hemorrhoids. Pregnancy can cause hemorrhoids. Ascites, so fluid accumulation due to cirrhosis of the liver, can cause hemorrhoids. Common symptoms result in burning, itching, and bleeding. 20% of these folks have what's called an anal fissure. This is actually a breakdown of the mucous membrane. It becomes, shall we say, an open wound that can bleed. So this is why some people who have hemorrhoids, they may wipe their bum after they've had a bowel movement and they'll find blood on the tissue as well. Conservative treatment includes local application of ointments, sitz baths, high fiber diet, and avoidance of constipation. If failed, medical treatments may require rubber band ligation, sclerosing, they'll put like a saline solution into it, which breaks it down and causes it to collapse, laser surgery, or cryosurgery. I talked about this in semester one, just like last week, and I have a woman in the class who actually works for a surgeon, a general surgeon. And quite often what they do is with external hemorrhoids, they'll band it. So they'll actually put a rubber band on it that kind of cuts off, almost like they do with the leftover umbilicus in a baby, right? They clamp it and the end dies and falls off. Well, they do the same here. But with internals, they actually have to go in surgically and remove them. And I guess it's a very nasty surgery. The patient is extremely uncomfortable for a very long time because they actually have to go in and cut the internal one right off of the mucous membrane within there. And if you haven't seen one, that's what they can look like. Pancreatitis, potentially serious inflammation of the pancreas and surrounding organs, that you end up with autodigestion of the pancreas by its own enzymes. What does the pancreas do? Do you remember? What does it squirt into the digestive system? No, that insulin's for its endocrine function. I'm talking about its exocrine function. So it does squirt something into, I always remember this, right? The duct of Odie. Did you guys take that? Remember the cartoon character Odie with a dog? That's how I always remembered it. There's a little duct that comes off the pancreas. So it does two things. It injects a bicarbonate type of compound. So you have to think about what happens is food in the stomach gets really acidic, right? It's to digest it. And then it leaves the stomach and goes right into the small intestine. And once it gets there, the small intestine can't deal with how acid the material is that's coming out of the stomach. So the pancreas then squirts a bicarbonate alkaline substance, which lowers the acidity of the chyme, as we call it, so that the small intestine can deal with it by it being less acidic as far as that goes. And that also helps break down. So there's enzymes that the pancreas also injects into the area that does help break them down. It can be acute. You just end up with it and it can be reversed, or it can become chronic, recurrent or persisting. So the pancreas, as I said, provides many hormones and enzymes. So this can result in many systemic problems, complications of the entire body. And there's lots of reasons why you can have pancreatitis. So many, in fact, I couldn't list them all. So you can find all of them on page 911. 2/3 of these cases involve gallstones and chronic alcohol consumption. So can be a result of that. It has increased over the years due to obesity and gallstone disease. So there is association with gallstone problems, and that can be, again, another step related to obesity as well. You can get inflammation of the interstitium of the pancreas and pancreatic tissue, and this is called the interstitial edematous pancreatitis, or you can have necrotic pancreatic tissue called necrotizing pancreatitis. So Obviously, necrotizing pancreatitis is far more serious than the intended misform. Alcohol, that's your common factor in normal cases. So it's suggested that alcohol and its metabolites have a direct toxic effect on the pancreas. It doesn't cause the pancreatitis, but it sensitizes the pancreas to multiple insults. So it does do some damage to it. If you have gallstones, it can be initiated by the reflux of bile into the pancreatic duct, because that's the other thing we have to remember. That duct of Oddi, it does run into the pancreas, but it also shares with the other duct of the gallbladder that's bringing bile into that area. So if you've got problems where you can get gallstones involved, well, the bile can't get into the intestine, so it's going to back up the sphincter or up the tube and go into the pancreas. Of course, bile in the pancreas would result in inflammation of the pancreas, therefore pancreatitis. Symptoms from mild, nonspecific abdominal pain to profound pain accompanied by systemic symptoms and organ failure. Pancreatitis related to gallstone disease can be persistent, well-localized, upright, right upper quadrant pain, and with a maximal intensity within 10 to 20 minutes, real quick. Fatty meals or drinking alcohol, of course, could make the pain worse, which kind of makes sense, right? Fatty meals results in the creation of more bile. Alcohol, of course, has its own effect on the pancreas directly itself. Nausea and vomiting occur in 90%. So we can see here, here's our sphincter of Oddi's right here. So everything's kind of here. We can see how the tube coming out of the gallstone, sorry, out of the gallbladder, also associated with the tube within the pancreas itself. So we've got bile coming down from the liver and the gallbladder, and then of course we have the enzymes coming in from the pancreas. So we have any gallstones here, you can see how this can start plugging this up. Bile will be continued to be created, coming down and heading all the way back to the pancreas, resulting in pancreatitis. Pancreatic cancer. Anybody here, anybody with pancreatic cancer? Most of us have. It's pretty common cancer. In fact, many, I believe, sports people and actors, they've kind of had it too. It is the third leading cause of death in the US. That's pretty high. It has the lowest 5-year survival rate after diagnosis, 9%. Only 9% of those diagnosed with this type of cancer live 5 years. So it's not a great cancer to get. Most arise from exocrine cells, and 95% are adenocarcinomas. So these are cancers that form in the glandular tissue, which lines internal organs and makes and releases substances in the body. So that, of course, would be those cells that create glucagon and insulin, right? Remaining include the islet cells and the neuroendocrine tumors. 10% of cases are genetic in nature, particularly what's called BRCA1 and BRCA2. And the reason I put BRCA1 and BRCA2 in here is simply because BRCA1 and 2 can cause pancreatic cancer, but BRCA1 and BRCA2 are also the same genetic issues that can lead to breast and ovarian cancer. So this BRCA1 and BRCA2 are the ones that females get tested for. If, say your mother has had breast cancer, they'll test them. So this is the one that and they've got some very good treatments for those with these type of genetic issues. And they can help a lot. But that's just so the reason I put in again is this BRCA1 and 2 have a relationship to all three: pancreatic cancer, breast cancer, or ovarian cancer. Most who develop pancreatic adenocarcinomas do not have a genetic or familial cause. And of course, the older you get, the more chance you have of getting it. What I found interesting was tobacco. It always seems to come back. Tobacco always seems to come back a bit. 20 to 30% of cases are due to tobacco, and tobacco actually doubles the risk of pancreatic cancer. Presence of type 2 diabetes and impaired glucose tolerance is also a risk factor. When we look at adenocarcinomas, there are usually multiple mutations, and they can be three types. And don't worry about the things at the end, but alterations in the oncogenes, which we've talked about, inactivation of the tumor suppressor stuff, and inactivation of genes involved in DNA repair. So you can see that within these types, they're all about things that involve either, changing those oncogenes, shutting down those parts that do suppress tumors, or breaking down those things that repair DNA. So everything in those three leads to a higher probability of DNA mutations, which results in the production of tumors. More than 90% have the alterations in the oncogenes in CRAS. Adenocarcinomas contain infiltrative glands of various sizes and shapes surrounded by a dense fibrous tissue. So they tend to grow within. They infiltrate the vascular spaces, lymphatic spaces, and perineural spaces. And it's interesting, they go from flat ductal lesions to papillary ductal lesions, which eventually become irregular and finally infiltrating the adenocarcinoma, which destroys the pancreas. So you get nonspecific and vague subtle onsets. So these folks go into the doctor, they're not hungry, they're tired all the time, they have nausea, fatigue, they're itchy, and they don't know what's going on. So, obviously, last thing on their mind is pancreatic cancer. Most are initially seen for abdominal pain, weight loss, and jaundice. And in that case, the disease has progressed significantly, and they're probably getting closer to end stage with this cancer. Pain is the common symptom because the tumor is pushed against the nerve. Pain can become intractable as it continues. You get jaundice, the yellowing accompanied by itching, very dark urine, and acolic stools. The stools here are clay-colored. The reason your feces is the brown or dark color that it is because your body's breaking down the bile that's in the gut as that material gets broken down further and further through the system. If the pancreatic cancer, obviously it's going to eventually block the bile duct as well as its own, so you're no longer getting bile into the intestinal tract, so therefore the feces ends up looking almost white, because you don't have the bile in it. Pancreatitis may also develop from obstruction of the pancreatic duct, so the pancreatitis may be the first sign, and then they look at that and discover that it's cancer. Development of diabetes or glucose intolerance is common, which would make sense, right? If it's going to destroy the cells that produce glucagon and insulin, of course that's going to affect it. It can metastasize first to regional lymph nodes and then via the hematologic and lymphatic systems to the liver, peritoneum, lungs, and pleura, bone, and adrenal glands. If you get tumors of the body and tail, you're twice as likely to get metastases to the peritoneum. It is difficult to diagnose in early stages, and that's what happens. We end up diagnosing it when they're much farther along. And the most common test in the initial look at it is a CT scan with contrast. So you would have a contrast placed in. Treatments depend on the stage of the tumor and can be three categories. Resectable, so they just remove part of it. Locally advanced represents 40 to 45%, and then metastatic, 40 to 45%. Again, because we don't get into discovering it until it's much farther along, so the chance of metastases becomes quite higher because we find it so much later. So, surgical resection provides the only curative therapy, but only for a minority of groups. Prognosis has very low survival rates, so 23% of those are alive 1 year after initial diagnosis. 23%, only 23% after a year. 5 year survival rate is at 9%. Now, it is my understanding that there is some very good treatments now for this. I don't know exactly what they entail, but some people are living a bit longer. Foodborne illness. So in the gut. So the first one is botulism. And it's the same stuff they inject in your wrinkles, right? Just smaller amounts. Rare, often fatal condition through the ingestion of a potent neurotoxin produced by Clostridium botulinum. And this is quite often found in preserved or poorly preserved canned foods as well as contaminated wounds. This is why I never ever buy pickles at a farmer's market. Won't do it because you have no guarantee that they've been canned appropriately. So I just get very nervous around it. There's five core categories for it. So it's either foodborne, can get it in a wound. Infants can get it, adult intestinal toxemia, and iatrogenic, meaning if an individual gets too much botulism injected for their wrinkles or so forth, they can actually get an infection systemically. Because what they do inject into you is actually active botulism. Yes. The anaerobic bacillus releases a protein neurotoxin that is heat labile. In other words, this is where pasteurization came in. So when people were getting ill with what we now know as botulism, when they were trying to can to store foods, because remember, you know, way back when, there wasn't refrigeration like we have now. So people were getting ill, and then, what was his name? Who invented pasteurization? Do you remember? Was it Louis Pasteur? I can't remember, but it was invented. And all you have to do is, this is why I can sometimes, anybody here can, like make your own jams and pickles, that kind of stuff. So this is why you once your jar's filled with things, you put it in a big container and you boil it for 15 minutes, and that pasteurizes and kills any botulism that might be in there, and then you're good to go. Sorry? It was Pasteur? Yeah. Okay. I guess that's why it's called pasteurization. bad food processing equals ingested neurotoxin. Infant botulism affects babies 3 weeks to 9 months. Honey is the source. Everybody knows you never feed a young child honey, right? Before 3 months, you never feed a child honey because you can increase the probability of botulism. Not always ingested orally, contaminated wounds with soil, chronic drug abusers, or after C-section can also get this. So when the neurotoxin is ingested, the acids in your gut and the enzymes in your gut cannot destroy the molecules of the toxin, and therefore it gets absorbed into the blood. So you eat the food, it gets absorbed into the blood, it then reaches the cholinergic nerve endings. You all know what those are now, right? Because you've been taking that this semester. So it reaches the cholinergic nerve endings at the motor end plate, and it binds to the presynaptic nerve terminals. And what it does, it stops acetylcholine production. Or not production, but release. So in other words, what's going to happen to that muscle if the neuron can't release acetylcholine? What's it going to do? What's going to happen to the muscle? Sorry? Yeah, so therefore it becomes, we can say paralyzed, right? Right, because the muscle can't contract. So it results in flaccid paralysis with normal sensory and mental status. So you just suddenly become paralyzed. Symptoms develop 12 to 36 hours post-ingestion. Most common, malaise, weakness, blurred and double vision, diplopia, dry mouth, and nausea and vomiting. You can get dysphagia, dysarthria, so slurred speech, so can't swallow, can't speak, and photophobia, which is sensitivity to light. Correct. Motor weakness of the face and neck muscles progresses to the diaphragm, accessory muscles of inspiration, and muscles controlling the extremities. And, of course, then if you can't breathe, then you can't live. Immediate treatment is injected botulism equine trivalent antitoxin. So they actually get it from horses, and they inject you with it, and it shuts it down. Removal of unabsorbed toxin is done by what's called gastric lavage and induced emesis. So gastric lavage is flushing it out, and emesis is vomiting. Ta-da! So everybody saw my message today, yes?